Welcome to Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the rare disease community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're in Pasadena, California today, speaking with Rigoberto Garcia, Executive Director of the Hemophilia Foundation of Southern California. Rigoberto's family is originally from Guadalajara, Mexico, though he's L.A. born and bred. Rigo has worked in public health for the past 20 years, mainly with community clinics in the San Fernando Valley and West Los Angeles. His focus has been on health education and community programming, and he's been with the Hemophilia Foundation for the past 2.5 years. Buenos dias, and thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you. Buenos dias.
Your focus has been on the difficulty of minorities, specifically people of color, in getting treatment for hemophilia and also getting into clinical trials. Let's start by talking about this, why it's an issue and even a bigger issue now than before.
One of the things is that many of the Latinos don't get involved with clinical trials because many of them are immigrants fleeing their country for various reasons. One of them is that they don't support or have faith in their government or their healthcare system is failing them. So when they come to the United States and they find out that there is a clinical trial, many of them think that, one, they're not going to get the proper medication during the clinical trial, that they're guinea pigs, or that they're going to use them as tests, as subjects. And we've seen that. And we've seen that with people of color here in the United States as part of our history. So it's very difficult to try to get them in to clinical trials. Now, with that same aspect in regards with healthcare, a lot of the times because they are immigrants and because we've seen in the past with depending who the administration is, it be a Republican or a Democrat, there are certain things that are put out there to scare the population. Over 4 years ago, 8 years ago, when we had a Republican administration, there was a lot of talk about ICE and how ICE vans were being set up, and there were some that were being set up by community clinics. So this is where I feel the fear is, especially within the last 8 to 10 years, as to getting more Latinos healthcare and into clinical trials.
I want to go back for a second. I mean, what you're saying can basically be said for people with a variety of rare diseases, not just hemophilia.
Correct.
However, I wanted to know if you find that the prevalence of hemophilia is higher in Latino populations.
Not necessarily prevalence higher in Latino populations, but we live in Southern California where we're very diverse. And our geographical area is not only Los Angeles County, Orange County, which is high population, but we also work with other counties that have a lot of immigrant farmland. And with those farmlands come farmhands. I would say that more than 50% of our population is Latinos, and we have around 60 to 70% are monolingual or bilingual in Spanish speaking. So we do have a very high percentage of population that does understand Spanish. Because of that, we host the largest all-Spanish conference in the nation, which is called Familia de Sangre. This last year, in 2024, we had 700 community members, and this is all Spanish community members coming to a conference that's completely in Spanish.
Okay, this brings me to a separate issue, and that's the difficulty of raising awareness among people who don't speak English as their first language.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things is that it's not only being able to provide the information. We can send out flyers, we can send out emails, we can send out, whatever we can, but we have to also realize that, not to put our community down, but having worked a lot of the community, their reading level is very low. And so being able to provide all of this information via email or whatnot, it's not getting to them because they might not have access to email. I mean, I'll talk about my parents. My parents came here over 50 years ago from Mexico. And, to this date, my mom still has issues with her email, but it's not. So it's just one of those things that because they didn't grow up with it, it's difficult to try to change a lot of that population to be able to use it as a form of communication. One of the things I'm trying to do is do more of the old school outreach where we're putting up, a stand, a puesto, with information and handing out information, but also being able to communicate verbally what we're doing, who we are, and how we can assist them. And I think that's one of the biggest things that's been missed with clinical trials and the different options available for healthcare.
Now, I want to ask you about discrimination as a potential issue. After all, it was California in the 80s that was the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic, mm-hmm. and hemophilia, at least in the beginning, was closely correlated with the AIDS epidemic.
It was, unfortunately. You know, we had many community members that passed away having a dual diagnosis with hemophilia and HIV or AIDS. You go, because we had the tainted blood, you know, we had, and within our community, a lot of times was called dirty blood, because we were affirmed by the U.S. government that it was safe to be able to get, you know, blood transfusions.
And it wasn't.
And it wasn't. It may have happened 40 years ago, but it hasn't been forgotten. So, you know, we have living community members that lost family members because of this.
So basically, hemophiliacs received tainted blood, and it wasn't the hemophilia that killed them.
Correct. It wasn't the hemophilia.
It was the HIV.
It was the HIV.
Incredible. So there's still some kind of a stigma associated with this?
There is a stigma. I mean, there's a lot of stigma even now with those that did survive and have HIV and have hemophilia, which we do have a large population. They're not out boasting that they have both of them, because you have to remember, in the 80s, HIV was correlated with homosexuality, which was terrible. At the time, Ronald Reagan did not talk about HIV publicly, you know, and that was horrible. So now, looking 40 years later, we have these clinical trials that are amazing, but trying to get those people to get involved has been very difficult because of situations like this.
So speaking of clinical trials and therapies, what therapies are most of your members here on?
A lot of them are taking factor medication.
Weekly infusions or?
They're doing weekly infusions, you know, or twice a week, depending on what medication they're on and depending on how active they are. That's how often they're taking their medication. And, you know, yeah, they're infusing through a vein, you know, through just like if you were to do an IV.
And so I'm presuming that your foundation helps get them that care and also helps arrange for insurance coverage.
Yes, we do have a community outreach coordinator. His name's Omar Torres, who has very well knowledge of insurance. And so he's been able to assist when needed or if there's lack of coverage. You know, we have great coverage with Medi-Cal here in California. We are celebrating 70 years of service this year. But I think one of the things that our foundation was very involved with was being able to put supplemental insurance, which is a GHPP, which whatever Medi-Cal doesn't cover, GHPP does.
So what's the average cost in dollar terms to treat hemophilia?
It varies, but it can be from $2,000 to $15,000 a month, depending on medication. There is no generic medication available. All is brand medication. And one of the biggest things is being able to find insurance that will cover this medication. And because it's so expensive, it's very difficult to try to get it. And like we said, you know, when someone is using Factor, you might be set up to use it once a week. Well, you may have a bleed because, you know what, you're walking down the street, you know, you twist your ankle, you have a bleed, you're using an extra vial, but now the insurance doesn't want to cover that extra vial because you were given for 3 months, and 3 months, that's 12 vials.
So that doesn't allow for any wiggle room here.
That doesn't allow for any wiggle room, and that's where it does get very difficult with our patients to try to get medication, and especially if you do not speak English, and if you go to one of our hemophilia treatment centers, and there's no one to assist you that may speak English, that is another barrier.
Now, what if you're in the country illegally?
Well, that's the thing. Medi-Cal now covers everyone. It doesn't matter your immigration status.
Are people, though, even though that may be the case, are they nervous about approaching authorities for fear of being deported?
Yes, and that's one of the biggest things that we see is that they are afraid of going for care because they feel that this might affect their immigration status in the future, that, you know, if they provide any information, especially for like a clinical trial, you're providing all your information, your home address. Are they going to come and pick me up if I step out of the clinical trial or whatnot? Here in California, I can state that Medi-Cal will cover all residents. Immigration status does not matter.
And specifically now, in this election year, immigration was a huge issue.
Correct.
How does that return of a Republican administration with Trump in the White House, how will that directly impact your operations, if at all?
I think, you know, having lived through this, working with Latinos in community clinics 8 years ago, I feel it's going to be the same battle where we do need to be upfront. We do need to let them know what we're doing, how we're doing it, and how their immigration status will not be affected by receiving care.
I want to ask you briefly about gene therapy. You know, we're talking about therapies that cost between $2 and $3 million, although they're considered one-offs.
Correct.
We don't really know the long-term impact if they are in fact a cure, or if people have antibodies that would disqualify them from receiving gene therapy. Are any of the people that you serve currently on gene therapy?
We have, overall, we have, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, we might have two community members out of the 3,800 that have received gene therapy. And I think one of the biggest things with that is that gene therapy is not a cure. That's what's one of the clarifications we want to make with gene therapy. But gene therapy does, I don't want to say simplify, but it will bring someone that has severe hemophilia to mild hemophilia. So, you know, their clotting factor does increase and they have less bleeds throughout the year, which is what you want. More bleeds create complications. Less bleeds, you live a quote-unquote more healthier life.
And also it means that you don't have to go get infusions every week.
Correct. Correct, or that you don't have to do them at home as often. It's not so much the cost, because some of the gene therapy pharmaceutical companies are there to assist. It's not so much the cost that's pushing people back. It's a misunderstanding and the misinformation that they have. I think when gene therapy came out, not all of the information and all the questions were readily available or could be answered because of legal reasons, because a lot of the gene therapy was going through FDA approval when it was already being promoted. And because of that, legally, they couldn't talk about how long will gene therapy last? What are a lot of the side effects? And I think being able, having the I don't know or I can't answer that question, the response from a lot of the pharmaceutical companies hindered gene therapy and more people using gene therapy.
I see. One thing I've noticed in covering rare disease is that other patient advocacy organizations with other rare diseases, such as Duchenne muscular dystrophy and sickle cell, have done specific outreach to the Spanish-speaking community.
Yes.
So do you work through NORD, for example, with other patient advocacy groups?
Well, we haven't started working with other patient advocacy groups. We do work with NORD and have done different partnerships with NORD and the Spanish-speaking population. Here in California, we have started, we created a coalition. So we're part of a coalition with rare diseases, that focuses on advocacy and advocacy issues. I think one of the next steps that we need to do is how do we continue to work with that beyond just advocacy, but education.
I see. And then last question, going forward, the cost of gene therapy could very well come down.
Correct.
As more therapies come on the market and as there may even be some competition. I wanted to ask, almost all hemophilia patients are male, but you have some women. You must have some females with hemophilia.
We do. Yes, we do. Hemophilia is not just a male disease, and that's one of the misconceptions, because we saw it so much as men being the ones that were diagnosed with this. A lot of the times, women are not diagnosed, which is very unfortunate, because their hormones may change. And when it comes down to diagnosis, there's a certain percentage line of coagulation that they have to have in their blood. You know, depending on different hormones, depending on their menstrual cycle, they may be above that line or under that line. You know, if they're above that line, they're not diagnosed. And so there are a lot of women that go undiagnosed or that get diagnosed later in life, which is terrible because they are not able to receive medication in the earlier years to prevent a lot of complications. I worked in women's health, and I was one of the problems when a woman of color would come in and they would let the, OBGYN, that they had heavy menstrual cycles. And it was told, well, a lot of women of color, a lot of Latinas do have heavy menstrual periods, and that's normal. You know, did your mom have it? Did your grandma have it? Did your sisters have it? They're like, yes. They're like, yeah, that's normal for you. And I was, unfortunately, one of those that, as a health educator in women's health, was saying the same story. Moving now into the hemophilia world, into the bleeding disorders world, we do know that that's not normal. You know, and now it's really trying to educate a lot of our women, a lot of our Latinas, that you should not have a heavy menstrual period. Your period should last, less than 7 days. Anything beyond that is abnormal. And that's where we should talk about getting tested. We should talk about what more needs to be done.
Well, we're just out of time. We hope that this can help raise awareness. Any way that we can help, we're happy to do so. We've been talking to Roberto Garcia, who is Executive Director of the Hemophilia Foundation of Southern California. This is Larry Luxner.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.